Hello and welcome to GCYM Conversations. I'm Andrew Ferris. In about a month, the Rooted Conference will be taking place in New York City, and we've been talking about it a lot at GCYM because we love Rooted a lot. And one of the contributors to that conference will be Mark Howard. Mark, who is a previous guest on GCYM Conversations, will be one of the presenters there. He's a steering committee member for the conference and on the board of advisors for Rooted. He's been in youth ministry for about 5 years, and now is working with Elam Ministries, a ministry that is helping churches, helping equip churches in Iran as the gospel continues to spread there, which Mark talks a little bit about in this interview. Well, at the conference, Mark is presenting a couple of workshops, one of which will be on teaching the book of Revelation. He also just published an article at the Gospel Coalition just this last week on that same topic. And so in the midst of all of that, we got Mark to come and talk for about an hour about the book of Revelation, how he approaches it, how he teaches it to youth, and why you shouldn't be scared of it. We hope you enjoy the interview. And by the way, check the show notes on this one for sure. There's all kinds of stuff in there, places to go to check out Rooted and Elam and some of the books that we recommend. It's all there in the show notes, so go take a look. Thanks. Did everything that everyone would ask without giving a second glance. But I know that I could spend more time. 5 years, and you recently switched to Elam Ministries.
I have, yes, which is an organization that works with the rapidly growing church inside of Iran.
Yeah, I had no idea until we were talking before we started recording about like how rapidly the church was growing in Iran.
It is. It's
Iran. Excuse me.
Very encouraging, and it's true. You. Particularly in the West, you don't really hear much good news coming outside of Iran. But that's partly because the Iranian government is trying pretty hard not to, to let this get out. And they're working pretty hard to try and subdue the church. But
yeah, so you've been working with them for just a little while now.
I have.
And you're doing what with them?
Well, I am a part of the team that tries to help communicate what they're doing to donors, potential donors, churches, different organizations here in the U.S. I also get to travel every now and again out there to participate in some of the training events that they do, which is incredibly encouraging and humbling. But
you know what you guys should think about doing to reach donors? You should think about having people dump buckets of ice on their head.
Well,
I don't know, just an idea. I bet it'll go viral.
So. There you go.
And then more germane to this conversation, not only your youth ministry experience, but you are super involved with Rooted. I mentioned in the introduction that this is one podcast, hopefully in a series of podcasts that we'll do with some of the people who are presenting at Rooted this year and doing workshops and that sort of thing. So you're kind of all over Rooted, man. That's where we met initially, and then where you'll be in October here. You'll be doing a couple of workshops, and you're on the steering committee, and you're on the board of advisors, and it seems like you're kind of Cameron Cole's lackey. That's what it seems like to me.
I'm definitely a Cameron Cole groupie. I love that guy.
but who of us isn't?
Exactly.
So, So you're doing a couple of we put out an episode with Cameron a couple of days ago, but Cameron was talking about some of the stuff that you were going to be presenting on this year at Rooted, and looks super interesting. Maybe you can talk through really fast, Mark, what those workshops you're going to be leading are. Just give us a basic overview of the two of them.
Sure. The first one that I'll be doing is on teaching the book of Revelation. So it's going to be some about basic principles of exegesis, but then it's going to be also kind of an apologetic for why I think books like Revelation, and Revelation in particular, is a really good one to be teaching to youth. But then I'll also, give it's one of those things that a lot of people feel very ill-equipped to teach. And so I'll be trying to give some resources that would help give people the confidence to teach it. So they'll come away with something pretty practical, hopefully feel equipped and encouraged to go back and to teach Revelation to their kids. The other one that I'm going to be doing is one that I'm really excited about. And it's on looking at contamination psychology and the way it impacts the way people relate to topics such as sexual purity. and specifically how damaging it can be if we don't also do it within a context that's saturated with grace. And so really it's going to be looking at contamination psychology, purity, particularly sexual purity, and the gospel of grace, and how those three things relate. So it's one of those issues that, you know, if you're in youth ministry, you just deal with sex and sexual purity. It's there, and a lot of us operate in a world that talks about, you know, the purity metaphor, and you have that purity movement with purity rings, other things like that. And anyways, I hope it'll be a very encouraging one, opening people's eyes to a lot of stuff that's going on behind the scenes when we talk about sex and sexual purity, and how oftentimes without meaning to, we don't really let the gospel inform how we approach purity and how we talk to kids about it.
Super interesting. Those are both really different and workshops, but I think it's a good little snapshot of like the reality of pastoral ministry is trying to figure out kind of both of those sorts of things, among others, is how you're leading in areas of teaching students the Bible and teaching them certainly about like just what it means to have received grace and all of that. So good stuff. I want to spend most of our time today talking about the first of those. And for those listeners who may be thinking, we really want to hear about the second one.
Yeah.
You will at some point, hopefully somewhere down the line, assuming, Mark, that this doesn't go terribly and you throw your headphones off and storm out of your office where you're sitting. That maybe someday we'll have you back on and have you talk about the sexual purity stuff as well. But the issue of revelation is interesting because, so like, I know I'm in a church with a senior pastor who cares a lot about the book of Revelation and who has, you know, written a book about it and all this kind of stuff. And definitely from kind of an older school, maybe of approach, where, and I don't know your approach, so I'm not assuming anything here, but where there's lots of interpretation of signs and symbols and trying to figure out kind of exactly what everything is. And then I know for me, I got to a place where after kind of reading about and hearing about that approach to Revelation, where you're really clearly saying like the Whore of Babylon's the Catholic Church or whatever it is, you know, like people are kind of doing the this is that sort of thing, which is, you know, incredibly popular teaching for a while in American evangelical culture, and still is, I think, in a lot of places. I was just turned off from the book of Revelation after all of that, because that was kind of all that I got for a while. And it took me a lot of studying to get back to a place where I think I started to appreciate the book again. But I was having this conversation with my senior pastor one time, who's a great godly guy who loves the Lord and who is a good Bible thinker on the whole, and who I respect a lot. And so this is not at all meant to rip on him. He's really thought his stuff through. But I had this interesting conversation with him where I was saying, you know, I don't know, you know, and what about all this stuff you've been teaching? And we've been kind of going over as a staff. He's been doing some teaching on what he thinks about all this stuff. And I was putting up some, not like full-on disagreement, but just asking some questions. But he said this really interesting thing, which was, he said, you know, my biggest concern is that people don't treat Revelation like it's eschatological fiction. Like it doesn't really matter at all for us, because we've so put it off to the side of teaching the church. We've all kind of run away from it because we think it's too hard, or all the teaching is such a mess that it becomes something that's not related to how the world actually is in any way. And it basically then loses what it has to say to the church, you know? And so I don't know, I mean, maybe you could start by just talking about kind of where you're coming from. And I love the idea of what you're talking about, because not only is it a curiosity for a lot of students, but I do think that my pastor is right, that for a lot of us, Revelation has become, we're so afraid of one side of interpretation that we just kind of jettison the book to the side. We'd never think about teaching it and all that. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, for sure. And that's what kept me away from it. You know, the first time I asked my students, hey, what do you guys want to study this semester? You know, I'd really love to do a book of the Bible. Cause that's what I typically did for the Sunday school, is we just went, you know, chapter through a book of the Bible, and like, oh, let's do Revelation. Let's do. I'm like, oh yeah, that's great. Let's not. And, you know, after two, 3 years of asking them and consistently having them ask me for revelation, I was just like, okay, well, you know, it's in the Bible. So, and you know, for those of us in ministry, how often do we have kids asking us to be like, hey, I really want to know what this passage means. You know, I really am, I'm point. Really interested in this book of the Bible. Can you teach it to me? Like, that just doesn't happen a lot. And so, you know, it's kind of like, well, they're asking for it. It's scripture. It is just naturally, for lack of a better word, it's just, you know, it's a sexy book. It's interesting.
Yeah,
it captivates people's imaginations. And but like you said, there's a lot of baggage that we bring to it. And so, you know, the first thing that I would encourage people to do is to kind of leave the baggage at the door and to try and take Revelation kind of where it's at, and let the book, and really let John, the author, let him dictate kind of how we should read it. And not, thankfully, in the first, you know, two verses, he really sets up a pretty good paradigm for how he asks us to view Revelation. And once you approach it from that perspective, it really actually, it starts to make a little bit more sense. And if you're able to, for a moment at first, tune out all that we want the passages to say and just take a minute and say, okay, what is it saying? What's it saying to its original audience? And then step back and say, well, then what does it mean for us? It's different. It, you know, it's a lot healthier perspective. The other thing too, well, do you want me to just go through real fast? Because I think it'll help if I just say what those four things are that I think it tells us about.
That would be great. Or I've just pulled up here.
Yeah.
Also the first couple of verses.
Yeah. So the first thing, I'm using the ESV. Is that what you're using?
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Okay. It says the first thing is
come on. I'm a broadly reformed gospel centered guy, Mark. Of course I'm using the ESV.
Okay. Yeah. Well, just got to check. So it says it's the revelation, right? So it's a revelation,
yeah.
Which means it's, you know, so it's the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants the things that must take place soon. He made it known by sending the angel to a servant, John, who bore witness to the word of God, to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. And so in this four chapters, first we see it's a revelation. Literally, it's an apocalypse. An apocalypse, mm-hmm. by definition, uses dramatic language. And so we should expect drama. We should expect that sort of active language that stirs our imagination. The second...
When you say that really fast, when you say an apocalypse by definition, you mean, I think I know what you're assuming,
okay.
Right? You're assuming that there's, that apocalypse was a culturally resonant category.
Yeah, it's a genre.
It's a genre of literature that in the first century, or depending on who you ask, maybe the very, very beginning of the second or something like that, I don't know. But I think the first century, when Revelation was written, that people would have known, they would have seen the word the apocalypse of Jesus Christ, and they would have known this is the kind of literature it is.
Yeah, right? Just like if I was to tell you, you're reading a poem, you would expect the syntax to be a little bit different. You might expect rhyme, or you expect certain things. And so when you see that this is a revelation, an apocalypse, you would expect certain things. The second thing, and for me this was one of the biggest things, is that it's a revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave Christ to show his servants, right? So this is Jesus teaching through John. And for me, you know, how does Jesus teach? When he was in the Gospels and he taught, what did he use most often? Well, he used stories. He used parables. And so when we come to this, it's an apocalypse and it's of Jesus Christ. He's the source who's giving this by the Spirit through the angels to John. We should expect story. We should expect image-driven narrative. And, just as when you're interpreting a parable, it can be unhelpful to go into all the details of, you know, the specifics of the parable. It's meant to be taken as a broad narrative unit. You know, that's a similar thing for Revelation. It's unhelpful, I think, and prone to error when you start digging down and saying, well, this detail relates to this and this relates to that. No, it's giving a picture, a big story. And just as with a parable, what you're wanting to do is like, well, what is this saying? What is this teaching? What is this story telling us is true? That's what we want to do with Revelation, is rather than nitpick all the details, say, okay, what is this telling us is true?
Do you think that that's how, that's also how contemporary readers of John would have interpreted Apocalypse? Do we have any sense of, were they doing lots of this is that kind of interpretation? Or were they, do you think they were doing more big picture? Do you know?
Well, you're asking outside of my expertise here with, you know, okay, I'm not right. much of an early church scholar. I've done enough to know that, I mean, it's like now you had some who did, some who didn't.
That's probably makes sense. Yeah.
So,
okay. Now I just didn't know if you know, it would be interesting to see more of what they were doing with like other apocalypses, you know, to see how people were interpreting those.
Well, and the thing is, you can make some connections to things that are going on, with empire and other things like that. You know, it translates to their culture with Rome. It translates to later cultures with, you know, whenever it's speaking about empire, and we live in a world where there are always empires. So at some level, it always does relate to something, and you can say, well, this relates to this. But there's a difference between the big picture. Like you can do with the, like the prodigal son, you can make connections with the son and with the father and with the older brother, but to say, oh, it was like, you know, it's on a path and that path speaks to this, and always with pit, you know, to like, oh, it was mud and mud is like, you know, if you go
the famous Augustine, the Good Samaritan, the innkeeper is Paul. That's what Augustine said about the parable.
You know,
it's like, I don't think so, Augustine.
Again, to me, it's like, I just think you're more prone to error on some of those things. The other thing that it says in this is given to show, and it said that it's something that he was given to show, and it was something that John saw. So again, it points us to this is image. This is image driven. These are word pictures, and that these images are not given here for our entertainment or for our intrigue, but because it's Revelation, because it's God's word, it's given here to show us the truth, to root us in that. And one of the things that I like to say whenever I'm teaching this is that John is not a tour guide who is giving a literal description of everything he's seeing. Such as when, you know, if I went to Turkey and I was going to say, oh, well, I saw this and it looked like this and it was this, this, and this. You could also, you know, I'm describing something this is not coming out well. But it's being literal in a sense that isn't always helpful in, because again, it's using signs and it's using symbols.
Yeah,
does
sure.
That makes sense.
It does, absolutely.
He's not a tour guide.
That makes perfect sense, especially because, especially if we are saying like there's a bigger picture that he's trying to get at, then it becomes less about an exact detail all the time and more about building a big picture.
And often the images have symbolic meaning that's important. So such as, to me, a perfect example of this is in Revelation chapter 21, where it's John gets this vision of he sees this new heaven and new earth, for the old heaven, the old earth had passed away and the sea was no more.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people read that and like, oh man, there's no sea in the new creation. There's no water. You know, how can you have paradise without an ocean, without beachfront property type thing? And to me, it's totally misunderstanding the genre. He's not a tour guide saying that beachfront property is not available in the new creation. Sea is a deeply symbolic image, specifically for evil and the realm of evil. It's where the beasts come from. You see it elsewhere in scripture, representing, you know, the waves of the ocean, representing evils pushing against the boundaries God sets up for it. The chaos of the sea, representing the tumult of the people. So when he says the sea is no more, you know, we might be like, oh man, that's a bummer. When you understand it as representing evil in the realm of evil, you're just like, okay, this is good.
With that image specifically, I was going to say just that I think that's a perfect example, because I think as a contemporary reader too, we get bummed about that. But they didn't have aquariums. They didn't have glass bottom boats. They didn't even have goggles. Like, I mean, just imagine the total like mystery of what the heck is down there, because they couldn't go around, and like they, whatever they caught was all they could probably see, like fishing caught, you know, that's probably all they could figure out. And there'd be, I mean, if imagine seeing a whale, if you didn't know what it was, or like, you know, or like a shark, it would just be terrifying. And to say nothing of like, they probably don't have, I mean, a storm on the little Sea of Galilee is threatening to destroy Jesus and his disciples. And I know that Sea of Galilee gets some real storms, but like, I can't imagine a modern boat gets sunk in the Sea of Galilee very often, you know, like it has to have something to do with sort of boat technology and just the ability to manage the sea. So when you see the sea is no more, there's this picture of chaos and mystery and evil and all those things kind of coming together, and you go, oh, no wonder they'd want that, right? Like,
yeah. Well, and I think it also, this is just to, again, poke on why I think this is so important to teach Revelation, why it's so helpful, is because, you know, we don't typically think about the images and the image-laden narrative even in the Gospels. So such as, even though it's a historical reality, I believe that when Jesus calmed the sea, you know, I also, when you understand the symbolism that's behind the sea, you understand it's not just him saying, oh, you know, I'm really powerful. He's showing as God's Messiah that he has come to subdue, that he has power over the sea, that he can subdue the sea. And I don't think it's luck that then Jesus goes on to, immediately after that, he goes and heals that demon-possessed man in the Decapolis, who's been in the graveyard. And remember, he has the legion in him, and the legion are like, oh, you know, don't send us, you know, don't get rid of us forever. Just let us go into the pigs. And so Jesus says, you can go into the pigs. And do you remember where they went and ran to?
Into the sea.
The pigs dive off and they dive into the sea.
That's interesting.
The same sea that Jesus just calmed. Subdued. Huh. The same sea that he walks on. The same sea that he enabled Peter to walk on.
Huh.
So you see, there is deeper symbolism going on, even in the Gospels, that we sometimes miss. But which once you do a thorough study of Revelation, you start to see these images and the way they appear elsewhere.
Yeah. So sum up then a little bit more of kind of your overall approach in terms of how you're going to read Revelation moving forward.
Okay.
So you're going to emphasize symbols and not so much interpreting the symbol in terms of it's exactly this, but broader communication. So
instead of a literalistic reading of Revelation, which is like a tour guide reading. I believe that the literal interpretation of the book of Revelation requires an understanding of the symbols being used. Hmm. So the literal translation, or the literal, not translation, the literal interpretation is a symbolic one.
Yeah, right.
So it corresponds to real life.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, fluffy. It's very practical.
So what you mean by literal is to take John at his word, to understand John as he meant to be understood, not necessarily literal in terms of like the scorpion is really a scorpion or whatever, but the idea that like the scorpion, what John meant when he wrote scorpion was something else.
Yeah, or like, so the description of the triune God that you get in Revelation chapter 1, where he sees this vision of Jesus, but through Jesus he sees the Ancient of Days, which would have been the Father, and he's surrounded by the seven stars, which is the Spirit. You know, rather than giving a physical description of, hey, you know, I want to describe for, you know, like you would describe me, oh, you're wearing a t-shirt and, you know, you have longer hair now. And, you know, you're giving a physical description of me that should be literally understood or literalistically understood as you were describing me. When John is describing Jesus or God in that first chapter, he's not giving a picture that we would then paint and say, oh, this is what God looks like, literalistically. It's layered in symbols. And so to really understand what he's saying about who this triune God is, you need to get at, well, what do these symbols mean? So that's my approach to it, is to say, take it for what it is, because John asked it. This is something he saw. It's of Jesus. It's revelation. So don't read it the same way you would a historical description of a physical location.
Yeah. So then, do you have a sense of what you would say, like, the message of Revelation is? Or do you see, like, a theme that ties it together?
There's a couple. I think the first is that God is in control. That's the first basic one.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, down here the waves are crashing and full of chaos, but before the throne room of God, it's a glassy sea. And the new heavens and new earth, it's no more. So you see that, again, he is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. He knows the story. So there's hope in that. So I think that's the first, is hope in God. He is in control. The second of that is, I think, you know, we often ask questions about evil and suffering. Does God care? And I think Revelation is a big part of that answer. Yes, he very much does care, and he is doing something about it. The third is, I think, one of the biggest ones is that, and this isn't mine, I think it's Beale, G.K. Beale, who maybe originally said it, but it's this, you become like that which you worship. And so it really deals with systems of idolatry. And, you know, so many of, we often think or conceptualize God as this person who's arbitrarily punishing people, and what you see in the book of Revelation is basically the punishment that God gives is always basically what people are asking for. So if an empire is living by the sword, if they're gaining their power by the sword, then the sword becomes their undoing. If someone is living by wealth, you know, if wealth is their ultimate thing, then you see basically economic distress is part of their undoing. And so it's a real warning. You see it again and again and again. Wow. What you worship, if it's anything other than God, ultimately becomes a punishment when you get that and when you get its effects.
That's really helpful, because that takes a lot of what you're seeing in Revelation, and that'll preach, you know? It'll preach so, like, the symbols and stuff are so rich that it'll preach, like, you could read that passage and it will be full, the preaching will be full of life and imagery in a way that's powerful, you know?
Yeah, but again, I think it's good to get the imagery, because, you know, one of the things I've seen done with Revelation a lot is you get, you know, it'll talk about the whore of Babylon, and it'll talk about adultery, and people will teach on that. You know, they'll teach a sexual ethic from it. And I think you can get a sexual ethic from Scripture, obviously. But Revelation is symbolic, and adultery, particularly in the Old Testament, you think of Hosea, it's a symbol for idolatry. And so you get the people of God are, you know, this is the woman who becomes the pure and spotless bride. And then you get the enemies of God, or those who are following the beast and the dragon, are called a whore. Not because they're all prostitutes, but because what it's saying is that they are giving their affection to someone other than God. As humans, they are made to give their affection to God. And so...
So Ezekiel 16, kind of picking up on some of the imagery of that, or Hosea, like you said.
Exactly. Like, well, and that's the other thing that you'll see is when you go through Revelation, more often than not, the imagery is Old Testament imagery. So if you want to, you see a symbol, you're like, "What? Where is this coming from?" The best, like, if you go to the good commentaries, you go to some of those good things, they'll point you back to the Old Testament, the prophets, some of those other things where you see that. And then the other thing too that I think is very helpful, and it gets back to the evil, is that it really sets up, Revelation sets up evil as a parody of God, a parody of good. And so, you know, you have, in Trinitarian theology, you have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Father, this is very, very broadly, so, you know, I know this is going to be, you know, poor at some level, theology, but God the Father.
This is going to come back to haunt you in a job interview someday, Mark. Somebody's going to listen to this and go, "You are not Orthodox in the Trinity."
Well, hopefully, I've qualified it enough that, roughly speaking, you know, God the Father being the one who ordains, who is at the plan level, the sovereignty level, the Son being the incarnate one, the one who enters into the physical reality of God's creation to enact that will, and then the Spirit of God being the power of God that is at work in the world. Okay, so very broadly speaking. And what you see in Revelation is that you have the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet who correspond to that. So the dragon is the evil that sets this like counter plan to God's. You have the beast being the incarnate reality of evil in this creation. And then you have the false prophet being kind of the power or the spiritual force of evil that's at work in the world. And you see these different levels interacting with the people of God, which, you know, is like I mentioned, personified as you either have the faithful woman or the bride or the whore of Babylon, who would be, you know, the one that's worshiping the beast as opposed to worshiping Jesus Christ. So
I love that point, because one of the things in my own studies as I started thinking through Revelation at some point was, as I got away from the this is that interpretation and I started getting toward just trying to follow the story and follow the tension in the sense that in the way that Revelation, I mean, even the way that Revelation with the series of sevens and how each seventh opens up a new seven, opens up a new seven and all that, it sort of builds plot tension really brilliantly throughout the book, because it just escalates and escalates and escalates and escalates as one seven leads to the next seven, yep, in terms of the framing of the book, you know, and the way that a history is unfolding or whatever. And so if you're reading the book and you're seeing the tension build and you're seeing characters come about and you're getting some sense of like who these characters are, what happens, I think, is that your own mind and heart are stirred in a really interesting way where it actually is, I think, a lot more captivating than just trying to say, here's what this means or whatever it is. And I think that kind of thing comes out so clearly anytime you're trying to teach any scripture, really to any level, but certainly to youth, that you actually are excited about the way that a book on a sort of literary level is doing what it's doing, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so seeing the like false Trinity thing that you're just talking about, I mean, it's just fascinating. It's like, whoa, look at how much, and what does that tell you about Satan and about what he is and what his limitations are, and what does that tell you about who God is relative to that? And that's super exciting, fascinating stuff as you're actually reading the book.
Well, and it, like you mentioned, it's mind shaping. Like when Paul talks about, you know, God wanting to renew our minds, it's not just replacing it with a new set of cognitive truths. It's actually reshaping our paradigm, reshaping our worldview, reshaping our imagination to see and live within this world differently. And narrative is incredibly powerful at doing that, and particularly for us in this generation of kids that are shaped by Harry Potter and Percy Jackson and Twilight and, you know, these narrative realities that are fantasy driven, you know, that Revelation reads a lot like those, and it has that possibility to really kind of shape. Because I mean, if that's how evil works, then it gives us new insight into how we can interact with truths in the culture, with different true statements, I guess is a better way, true statements in the culture. Because you can, if evil is a parody of good, then in every untrue statement, if it's a convincing untrue statement, it probably has a tinge of truth to it. And so our job then becomes saying, okay, well, that sounds good, but just because it sounds good doesn't make it true. So let's think about this. What is it? You know, once you understand how evil works, once you understand how lies work, according to Revelation, you can start seeing the half truths in the world, and coming up with the, you know, every good half truth is a parody basically of the gospel. And so, you know, for us then as Christians, rather than whenever some untruth becomes very popular in the culture, rather than being like, oh no, or, you know, being all angry or all up in arms or getting all in, you know, this righteous indignation. Thank you.
Instead
of getting this righteous indignation, or feeling like we need to, like, oh, pull away, we need to get away from this. As Christians, if we can say, well, if it's that popular, it must be because it's partly true. It must be a parody of the real truth. There is, in my mind, in all those situations, there is an incredible opportunity then to preach the gospel once we stop and say, okay, well, what is the half truth? And then, you know, from that, you know, what is the truth? So I think it gives us a way of interacting with the world that is helpful. And I think particularly for kids, for youth who, you know, in my context, a lot of them had grown up in the church, and so they knew a lot at a cognitive level. And so, you know, my job wasn't as much to, like, teach them all these stories, because, you know, their Sunday school teachers had done a lot of that, you know, the basics. My job was to try and help them see that they're real and to get their imagination shaped. And again, I think Revelation is a powerful book for that. It certainly was in my own life.
Yeah, that's a helpful thought. And I think we underplay the significance of, I think it's in line with what Walter Brueggemann calls the prophetic imagination, and sort of the idea of just like re-scripting how we view the world and a lot of that kind of stuff, that something has to happen in our own minds and to where we are interacting in the world with a mind shaped by the symbolism of Scripture and as a counter to the sort of all the scripts that you are kind of constantly, to keep stealing Brueggemann's language, the scripts that you're constantly sort of reading as part of our world. And what you were talking about earlier with the kind of different aspects of idolatry coming out, where the person who is sort of trusting in their economic vitality or something, you know, I mean, that's a modern American script as much as anything else, or trusting in the empire to provide, or whatever it is, you know, or the sword. You see people doing all of those things, and that becomes, that is totally, at least in American culture, contemporary idol worship is all of these different things, you know?
Exactly. And I think that's why Revelation is so helpful, because for a lot of us, when we think of idolatry, like, oh, we don't do idolatry. I don't pray down to any, you know, I don't have any, like, little metal gods or anything like that.
Yeah.
It was like, but the way idolatry is presented in Revelation, and you see what people are actually worshiping, and once you get behind the, you know, it's the basic, it's money, it's power, it's military might, it's their own, you know, ability to be creative, and you know, it's themselves.
It's the creature rather than the creator, ultimately.
It's all the things that we, you know, you can't come out of Revelation without getting a sense of, wow, I really am an idol worshiper in my heart.
That's really helpful, and I know there's a lot more to say. I'm going to leave it mostly at that on the exegetical level, unless there's something else you really wanted to chime in, Mark. But I wanted to get to a little bit of what happened as you were teaching it to your youth, and then any other thoughts you had moving forward on kind of how to bring some of that material to students. The rest of it, maybe they'll have to come to Rooted to hear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm so kind of basic and old-fashioned in this sort of old-fashioned, I don't know how to say it. Like, I like just going chapter through chapter or segment through segment. So it's, to me, the first thing is you need to have a good outline. That goes back to exegetical, but you need to have a good outline that's going to shape what narrative units you're going to teach on. And then, you know, I think it's, the way I would do it is I would get my head around what are these symbols. And at the front end of a teaching session, I would be like, okay, let's look at this Old Testament symbol of this. I give them the symbolic context. Then when we read through it, they can get at some of that. And so, because part of it is, you know, I don't want them to be dependent on me for their whole lives. I want to help train them to read scripture, particularly apocalyptic literature, because that's the stuff that a lot of them are interested in, the Ezekiels, the Isaiahs, you know, the crazy stuff. You know, that. So I want to teach them to do that, as well as to shape their imagination to see things differently. And so, I think the first thing, you know, it did take a while, because it is a tough book. And it is a different type of book that I think, you know, most of my kids have spent most of their life in Paul, or, you know, where it's like propositional statements and it's theological truths, or they've been taught the gospel stories, but they're taught them kind of on a, well, you know, Sunday school level, where it's, you know, some sort of a historical little story that's nice and cute or something like that. And so to get in to this and to shape their, it took some, you know, I asked a lot of them, I was asking a lot of them, when we did this, but again, they were engaged. They wanted to know. And it is nice because two chapters, you know, after the first chapter, you kind of set it all up, and then, you know, then you get to the seven churches and it feels similar. You know,
Right.
It feels similar, although again,
it's sort of in between because you've got the symbolism to start off each one of them, you know, and the different pictures of who it's addressing and all that kind of stuff, and but then it feels like a letter after that, so
it does. And then you get into, and so you do get a little bit of an ease into both for the teacher and for the students. But you know, when we went through it, I think partly for me it was learning some of seeing our idolatry, you know, seeing them come to the point where they no longer conceptualize idolatry as, you know, bowing down to a little figure. It's as trusting in something other than God. And starting to, you know, see them make connections between, oh man, you know, we put a lot of trust in money. We put a lot of, and I think the hardest thing, and this is going to be stepping on toes maybe, but I think the hardest thing in this is when you see, and when you start to apply Revelation, particularly the end parts, or not the end parts, but once you get past the letters, you start to apply it to your contemporary reality, and you really start to see the way the American Empire really mirrors a lot of the Babylonian Empire, which is mirroring the Roman Empire, and you see it's a tough one. It's a tough one because it really does expose you to some of the systemic flaws in the way we do empire.
And to bring the conversation full circle to some degree, that's a lot of what my own senior pastor is pointing out all the time as he's reading Revelation, and that's where I disagree with him on some of the exegetical stuff probably. Where a lot of it still is really relevant because he's bringing out those same principles that are just obviously there in the text, and you're looking around going like, whatever this symbol exactly is, we certainly fulfill a lot of it. And you know, whether or not John meant America when he wrote it, that's maybe a different question. But what's hard to debate is, like, I mean, trust in economics and the sword is pretty clearly a part of the American story, you know.
Yeah. Well, and it also provided, you know, I felt like I was probably a broken record when over and over again, I was just like, you know, if you're putting your trust and your hope in something other than God and his way, then it's going to come back to bite you. It's going to let you down.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a lot of them for us just like, you know, dating isn't bad. It's not bad to have relationships. But if you make those relationships an idol, it's going to let you down. You know, money isn't bad, wanting a good career isn't bad, but if you make that an idol, if that's what you set your hope on, your hope for yourself and your hope for meaningful existence is making a lot of money, then, you know, it's an idol. If your hope, you know, I live in the South, so a lot of people like guns. They feel like guns are incredibly important part of, you know, being a human. And particularly being a good, for the men, you know, being a good man, being able to protect. And it's just like, again, it's like, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying that protecting isn't, you know, a good thing to do. But if your ultimate hope is in your military might, you've made it an idol.
Yeah.
And it's going to be your undoing. Yeah. So it's like, you know, I felt like you kept hitting all these hot topics. And you kept hitting all these, you know, all the things that you'd like to talk to your kids about, but you'd like, without like, hey, I want to talk to you about guns. You know, I want to talk to you about sex. I want to talk to you about money. It just comes up.
Yeah.
It just comes up. And it comes up in a way that they don't expect it, you know, cause it's not like Paul saying, you know, giving a list of bad things you shouldn't do. It's about wasps coming, you know, it's like, it's about all these different things. So anyways, it's a good book for that.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about that is just that if you want to do all your teaching only based on books that seem overtly relevant, to a student's life or whatever, you're going to end up in Paul a lot. And you're actually going to have a hard time with lots of Paul as well. But you're not going to teach a lot of different parts of the Bible. And I think like there's part of the thing that this brings up is just a model of discipleship and Bible teaching in youth ministry that isn't just built on like speaking to youth where they're at, so to speak, but that's built on forming them to think and to live with a biblical framework in their minds and to kind of insert themselves into the broader story of Scripture. Sometimes I've put it in terms of like, it's not about God entering your story. It's about your story being a small part of God's broader story in the world. And you cannot know how you, what role you play in that story. You can't know it unless you know the whole story.
Yeah.
And so, so reading Revelation is a way of inserting ourselves more into the broader story of who, of what God is doing and thinking about the world through his eyes and through the lens of that one picture. And when you talk about even the word eschatology, you know, people associate that with straight up end times, interpreting Revelation kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think you know, we even would want to take that backwards and say eschatology is a lot broader than that. It's the entire outworking of God's plan in history. And so Jesus's first appearance is, or first advent is coming, or Jesus' first advent is part of eschatology, and you know Ezekiel is talking about eschatology, and so I mean, just saying like this, the whole story is broader, and reading Revelation as part of that helps us insert ourselves into that story instead of just saying, "Don't be an idol worshiper" or whatever it is. So
well, and towards that too, I will say too, I think when you read the New Testament in its canonical context, and you read all the Old Testament understanding of what will happen at the end times, you end up discovering is that when Jesus says, you know, when Mark says at the beginning of his gospel, you know, this is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, he's basically saying, you know, the end times that the prophets foretold started when Jesus came, with his first coming is when. So if you talk about it, it's the story of the end times. Well, sure, but we're living in the end times,
right?
From a canonical salvation history perspective, there will be a consummation when Jesus returns. I'm not trying to say that there won't be. There's going to be a consummation when Jesus returns, but the end times began with Jesus and we're living in them. So it is, it's a good book. It's a hard book though. It is. It's an uncomfortable book to study.
So for those who won't be able to make it to Rooted, is there a book or two that you have found to be helpful?
Yes, there are three books that I use because, again, you know, thankfully God does not ask us to do this all on our own. That He gives us many others who've gone before us and come after us. And three of the resources that I became my lifeline. One is The Returning King by Vern Poitras.
I was
going to
say that, Vern Poitras. That book is awesome.
That, for me, that's a book you need to read before you start the teaching.
Yeah.
You need to read that.
It's short, too. It's like, what, 120 pages or something?
Yeah, well, and the last half of it is like verse by verse exegesis. And I don't think this is me personally, I don't think that's that helpful. What's helpful for me is the first part where he sets up the paradigm of some of those big pictures, the counterfeit Trinity, the nature of idolatry, general outlines. You know, that is worth its weight in gold for setting the paradigm in which to read Revelation.
Totally agree. That book is where I first learned a lot of that stuff too. It's very, very helpful and very accessible. You could easily read it before you did a whole series on it. Just really highly recommend that. And that's also a good book to give if you've got a student who wants to go a little deeper or something like that. That's the kind of book you could give to them and they'll understand it. It's very clear and very well done. Poitras is pretty brilliant and a good communicator.
So for me, that was helpful on a paradigm level, setting up the paradigm within which to move. The other book that I read each week in prep, the given section was N.T. Wright's Revelation for Everyone. because he's a historian.
Yeah.
And he has a good understanding of Greco-Roman culture. And so he often has really, really good insights into the Greco-Roman backgrounds for what's going on. And so I find that very helpful to read, to get at it from that perspective. Also, at times he does application too, which is helpful.
Cool.
But that book is so high level that you're gonna constantly run into questions that he's just not gonna answer and not even gonna try. He just sidesteps a lot of the issues that if you're actually reading through it, you're gonna want more on. And then so for me, the like, oh my goodness, this book is so ridiculously dense. But it's worth its weight in gold. It's NIGTC, The Book of Revelation by G.K. Beale.
Yeah.
Nothing is massive, but it is exhaustive.
Yeah.
It's exhausting, but it's exhaustive. And so I didn't read every page of like 1,300 pages, but you know, you get to those passages that are those the minefields. They're the ones where you know something's going on, you just don't get it.
Yeah.
That's when I would go to that book, and he would give you all the he's particularly good at Old Testament backgrounds, intertestamental backgrounds. It's thoroughly exhaustive with all the different perspectives and weighing and critiquing them. And so and even if you don't know Greek, it's just skip over the Greek parts and you could get a feel. A feel of it. And so those are the three books. The Poythress for the big picture, the N.T. Wright, because it's more accessible than the Beale book, and it does a good job of giving you some of the backgrounds and some of the basic ideas of what's going on. But then that Beale book is, I mean, it's like, I think it costs like $60, and it'll be a pain to carry around, but it's worth it.
That whole series is like that, though. It's just like, most of them are just fantastic, but they're just dense, man.
Yeah.
They're dense. I don't know if you've ever used the First Corinthians commentary there by Anthony Thistleton, but it's tough to wade through. It's really good, but it's tough to wade through. That's a great like lineup of kind of different level books that you can have on hand. And I think that kind of thing is really helpful when you're going through something you're just kind of reading along, and then something you're using just for reference as you're going is really good. I would also throw in, I don't know if you've seen, in the little New Testament theology series, just the small little paperback books, but Richard Bauckham has a theology of Revelation, and he's really good about bringing out a lot of those kind of symbols and things like that as well, and pointing to Old Testament background. It's not a commentary; it's picking up biblical theological insights, but it's also that book is kind of thrilling to read because he's so good at being in the feel of Revelation that stuff we were talking about like. How to kind of get your mind into the story and stuff.
Yeah.
Bauckham is brilliant with that. So I'll link all those in the show notes. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking about teaching Revelation, I'll put those all in the show notes. You can click through to there, and we'd be glad to help you out there. Hopefully,
the Poythress one is online for free.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You can get a full version of it.
Great. I'll link both. I'll link the book and then I'll link the online free version. Mark, just send that to me afterwards, and we'll make sure and link both of those in case sometimes people like to have a book too. So,
oh yeah, for sure.
We are out of time. This is really helpful. Thanks. And for more on this, go to Rooted. Go to Rooted. It's going to be good. Mark is going to be doing a lot of stuff there, and you can hear just how thoughtful of a guy he is. And that will be part and parcel of the kind of people contributing at the conference, just people who really are speaking well about things they've thought through into youth ministry situations. So check those out. I know that's the main thing, Mark, you wanted me to plug. You also were talking about beforehand with Elam Ministries, Iran30.org. Can you talk about that? Or Iran30.org?
If you are interested, like either if you don't believe me that things are going on in Iran, or you hear that and you're like, oh, that's exciting, I want to learn more, I would encourage you to go to Iran30.org. So it's www.Iran30.org. And what it is, it's a 30-day prayer guide for the nation of Iran and the people of Iran, but it gives you a sense of what's going on. Also just in youth ministry, you know, if you know you ever want to do one of those prayer guides, it's an encouraging way, because God is just very powerfully at work there and in ways that we don't often see here. And so it could be a very encouraging thing for you and possibly for your kids. So I would encourage you to go check it out. And they certainly need your prayer. So,
cool. Cool. Well, Mark, thanks again for taking the time. We, you can follow everything we're doing with GCYM Audio on iTunes. Subscribe to us there. Just subscribe to God Centered Youth Ministry there. The link, of course, is going to be in the show notes as well. Subscribe to us on iTunes, where we would just be so happy if you would rate and review us. That would be a big help to us. And follow us at God Centered YM. Send in your questions. If you have any follow-up for Mark or anything like that, I'm happy to pass those along. So godcenteredyouthministry@gmail.com. And would love to interact further about any of this stuff. Or if you have a question for the regular GCYM podcast for me and for Lindquist and Kyle, send those there as well. And for all of your God-centered, gospel-saturated, theologically-driven youth ministry resources, check out godcenteredyouthministry.com. Go to Rooted, rootedministry.org. There's everything that you need, or maybe .com, I can't remember. That's also linked in the show notes. .com, sorry. Rootedministry.com. Go to the conference. It will be good. Mark, thanks again, man. Any last comments or anything?
I encourage you to read the Poythress, and if you're not hooked after reading The Return of the King, the initial part, and if you don't feel empowered after the initial part, then, well, I really hope you will.
Yeah, then I don't know what's going on. Perfect. All right, man. Thanks a lot. Bye. We recorded with Cameron the other day and titled it Cameron Cole in a World of Mixed Messages. So.
I love that guy.
Dude, he is... I don't know if I've told him this, but like me and my friends who run our site, like we immediately, as soon as we came to Rooted, we just felt so much like fellowship, like kinship with Rooted and everything it is, you know? But like out in California... it just feels like the West Coast version. Like we don't have a conference or anything, obviously, but just feels very like we started our website because we were like, there's a lot of gospel centered talk, and then there's the old youth ministry paradigm. So kind of what about bringing those two things together?
And it's twain to meet.
Yeah. Right. And so we figured out like, well, we don't see anybody else doing this, and we don't think we're experts, but nobody's trying it, so we'll just try it and see if we can just start thinking together a little bit. And then as soon as we published, we started seeing Rooted stuff come up on TGC, which was great. Like, we were just encouraged by it. And so anyways, we've gotten to know Cameron a little bit. We're all just like, big man crushes on Cameron.
Oh, yeah.
just because he's just the coolest dude, man.
So. Yeah, he's my Rooted roomie for life.
That's great.